powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
Hi, I'm Ella Joyce, and when I'm in New York, I listen to WBAI 99.5 FM. The more you listen, the more you learn.
Hi, this is Chloe Glickman, and I'm an intern at WBAI. Looking to get professional experience doing something you're actually passionate about? At WBAI, I'm able to develop skills in journalism, marketing, event planning, editing, social networking, and much more, all while working directly with producers and the management team. BAI is always taking applications for credit and non-credit internships, so get in touch today. Send an email to internships@wbai.org for more information. Join the team that supplied New York with independent radio for over 50 years. Help keep community radio going strong.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale. On Tuesday, June 20th, my guest on EcoLogic will be meteorologist Tom Weissmuller, who will predict this summer's weather and hurricane season and explain how El Niños and La Niñas in the western Pacific Ocean and storms in the western Sahara Desert will affect our weather. That's Tuesday, June 20th at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Listener-sponsored, commercial-free, community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels.
Good morning. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to this Juneteenth edition of Vantage Point on 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network here in New York in collaboration with ycradio.org. That is the York College radio station. Well, we're just running a couple of seconds behind. We have a great show lined up for you today. First and foremost, we want to continue to encourage you to become WBAI buddies. We always do that at the top of the show just by simply becoming a monthly sustaining contributor. You make a great contribution to WBAI. You do that by going to give to WBAI.org, give to WBAI.org, and that's for as little as $10 a month, you can become a WBAI sustaining person, and that is by becoming a WBAI buddy. Well, today's show, we have really three big things we're going to do. First of all, the legacy of Tupac Shakur. Was he a revolutionary? It's a question that we'll be posing shortly to Paradise Gray, one of the founders of X-Clan. And then we want to get into Bill Maher's use of the N-word. Should black folks be concerned? Earl Ofari Hutchinson will join us for that. And then we're going to have an extended period of time for you and the audience, much more time today than we normally allot. Usually we have about 20 minutes. Today we're going to have about 40 minutes to have you call in and express your opinion on those two questions. Before I go further, just want to say belated happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there. I'm sure everybody had a great day, and we hope they did have a great day, and that we recommit to being good fathers. Very important in terms of particularly the crisis we face in black and brown communities. We need good fathers to be out there mentoring, teaching, sharing, being partners with our wives and significant others, and not just operating from a patriarchal model. Okay, well, we're ready to rock and roll here, so to speak. No, I shouldn't say rock and roll, because it's really about hip-hop, as we're talking about Tupac Shakur. Let's go to our very first guest, who is our in-resident expert on hip-hop and everything so associated, and that is none other than Paradise Gray, who joins us from Pittsburgh. He is a co-founder of X-Clan. Brother Paradise, welcome again to Vantage Point.
Hey, how you doing, Dr. D?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. How you doing? First, I want to ask you quickly, because like I said, I sent you an email. We could have used the whole hour on this discussion today. But how's the work going on the hip-hop museum?
It's going kind of slow, but the staff is incredible. We could use some extra money, that's for sure. We need to get our fundraising game up. But, you know, we got my man Rocky Buchano and Curtis Blow and a whole staff of incredible hip-hop historians and educators working hard to put things together.
Well, that's great. Well, let's get right into the Tupac conversation, because I actually decided to go treat myself. My Father's Day gift to myself yesterday was to go and see All Eyes on Me. I think it's the name of the movie, but Tupac Shakur.
Yes, sir.
It's easier for me than having to read a whole lot of material and whatnot. And I'm sure, you know, there'll be critics of the movie. It probably doesn't do everything it ought to do. But for me, a novice, it was quite revealing, because there were things about it that I really had not been very aware of. And so I just want to weigh in with you on Tupac and just in several ways. First of all, I had not been aware of the closeness of his relationship with Jada Pinkett.
Yes, absolutely. Tupac was a ladies man, you know, and the ladies loved Tupac, that's for sure. And Jada definitely was a very close friend of his.
Right, and in that instance, it seems more to be sister and brother than having sort of, for lack of a better term, a romantic context. She seems to have been a sisterly soulmate who they appreciated each other, their craft, their commitment, you know, I guess coming out of similar circumstances in Baltimore and whatnot. So it didn't seem to, at least in the movie, it didn't come off as really being kind of a romantic relationship, but more of a very solid sister and brother relationship.
Yeah, well, I like to remind people that it is a movie, and, you know, Hollywood can, take it either way it wants to go, depending on the script writers.
Right. But anyway, that was something that, to me, I had just, you know, I know that even till this day, I hear that Jada Pinkett Smith now, you know, does contribute to causes and has some consciousness and so forth, but I had never been aware of this connection.
Very much so.
In fact,
people would be surprised how many artists, movie stars, and recording artists make incredible contributions to society every day, but you won't see it on the front page.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess the other thing that came through, too, obviously, is Tupac's roots, you know, this, you know, with his mother, being with the Black Panthers and her, you know, very strong commitment to revolution and, of course, Mthulu Shakur and that, him growing up with that influence. Talk to us about that background.
Well, that was a heavy, heavy influence in Tupac, the person. And many times it came out in Tupac, the artist and musician also. Sister Afeni had Tupac while she was at Rikers Island. You know what I mean? So Pac was, he was born in the struggle, for real, for real. You know what I mean?
Right,
both
right.
Parents deeply embedded in the Panthers. The streets heavily influenced him also. But the great thing about it is that he had elders that he could reach back and touch and get information from. And if you really, really want to hear the Tupac that you really don't hear in the media, go to YouTube and Google and just search for Tupac on YouTube. You'll find so many interviews that people have done of Tupac where he really, really gets deep and conscious. So don't just rely on the movie and Hollywood to give you the story. And don't be disparaged and discouraged from going to see the movie because of bad reviews either. You know what I mean? The movie is still a great success. It made $27 million over the weekend and came in third place. And this is with all of the bad reviews from Rolling Stone down. You know what I mean? Don't let these magazines, newspapers, and people tell you not to go see it. Because remember, it's just a movie. There's, how many movies did they make about Batman or Superman? Come on, we can get a better movie. But we don't need Tupac's movie to be a flop. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Well, I got to say that when I rushed off yesterday to see the movie, I anticipated a full theater, really. And I was like, well, you know, my wife and partner is working on a paper, so she was not going to go. And so it was okay. I knew I would find a seat because when I go with hers, we have to sit a certain distance and all kind of different things. So
right.
But when I got there, I got to say it was the matinee and perhaps the evening shows were fuller, but there were exactly 14 people in the theater. And that was, to me, very, you know, disappointing, frankly. I thought the theater would have been absolutely,
right,
you know, packed.
I understand
and
what
of
you mean.
That, well, it was like maybe
look
of
at
that
what rumors
14,
did to the Nat Turner movie.
Hmm?
Look at what the rumors and the bad reviews did to the Nat Turner movie. And I thought
right.
The Nat Turner movie was incredible.
Right. Well, I would encourage people to go and see it anyway. I mean, the people who were there seemed to enjoy it. And again, I'm a novice, so I don't know. I couldn't be a heavy critic because for me, I'm learning. I'm sitting there, you know, because I'm sitting there as a scholar, a student, you know, trying to learn. And I learned a lot. And again, you know, having you on today helps to fill in the blanks and to amplify, to deal with different aspects that may have been overglorified and whatever. But it came through to me in a very complex way, the complexity of a lot of this, but also, you know, the influences and the difficulty of trying to be a man-child in the promised land, so to speak, you know, is a part of that. And you know, that's why I wanted to bring you on, because you're, again, our resident expert on all things hip-hop, you know, for the
Thank you very much, my man. I'm just such a lucky person that I got to participate in the culture of hip-hop. And, you know, I got to meet Tupac personally on many occasions. And one occasion, Tupac traveled with X-Clan. We were on tour. And one particular moment that stands out for me is we took Tupac to a high school with us in Oakland, California. And Tupac was, at that time, he was still a dancer for Digital Underground and was wearing his Digital Underground jacket. And none of the students knew him at all. And we were right there in Oakland where he was living at the time. And we had him speak about Asala Shakur, and who is also, you know, his aunt. And that wasn't probably spoken about in the movie, I doubt. But Tupac was a very, very complex individual. And he lived his life in the media in front of us. You know, so many people had opinions of him. But one thing I loved about Tupac was his vulnerability as an artist and a human being. And the fact that he covered everything in his life and his music. So his consciousness is in his music. His ignorance is in his music. You know what I mean? And he wore his emotions on his sleeve. So he was a firecracker that was likely to go off at any minute. You know what I mean? But it was all there in the public. And how difficult is it to live your whole entire life in the public eye?
Well, the wearing the emotion on the sleeve definitely came through in the movement in terms of his volatility. You know, that came through in terms of his, you know, his you know, he was ready to throw down. But in a way, one looks at that in terms of, you know, given the circumstances, and that hasn't particularly changed since I came up in the Hill District of in Pittsburgh. You know, I mean,
yes, sir.
Being ready to defend yourself, sort of the creed of, for lack of a better term, the ghetto, being able to have this macho, mano a mano kind of thing inbred in us, you know, and so I don't
absolutely,
you know, that seems to be kind of par for the course. Talk to us
right.
about this, this the bad boy death row rivalry. How did give us your insights into how this all unfolded? Because that obviously was an important theme, you know, in the
yes.
in the movie. What seemed to be some misunderstanding between he and Biggie, and you know, and of course,
I think it really started on the level of Suge Knight and P. Diddy having problems, and how the media and the entertainment industry still like to play black men against each other, similar to like they did when we were in slavery, and they had the Mandingo fighters go from plantation to plantation fighting each other. American media and entertainment industry, particularly in hip hop, they still like to try to take the biggest, baddest black guy and have him argue or fight against the other bigger, blackest guy. And for some reason, that's extremely entertaining. Even to this point now, they're doing it with the female rappers. And it seems like the only time you could generate a big buzz about your music nowadays is if you have a rivalry and you're fighting against another rapper. You know, and I like to remind people also that the same hip-hop blogs and magazines and stuff that are giving this movie bad reviews are the same ones that were very complicit in the deaths of Tupac and Biggie, because the media, every time you turned around during this so-called East Coast, West Coast beef, which really wasn't about East Coast, West Coast, it was really Death Row against Bad Boy. It was a record company thing. It was all about money. It was all about, you know, nothing real. There was no real things going on there. Tupac had got shot and robbed in the lobby of Quad Recording Studio on 48th and 7th. And Tupac had heard through the grapevine, and there was a lot of rumors that Biggie may have been involved in some kind of way, but that never really panned out. There was no real information that ever pointed to Biggie or anybody from P. Diddy or them having anything to do with that incident. And all the media just kept blowing it up and blowing it up. And every time you turn the page, everybody on the radio was talking about it. Everybody in the news was talking about it. And it just kept escalating until it led to both of their deaths.
Well, in the movie, it is, and I didn't take a pencil. I needed to take notes. I had to try to remember things. And when I came home, I tried to take notes on certain things to talk to you about. Because in the movie, that's the person who was going to record at that studio. That brother's name was Neil or something. Well, I forget now. I should have remembered that name. But the way they portrayed it is as if when Tupac decided that he was going to go off on his own, there was a little beef between the two of them, and a couple of this guy's lieutenants decided on their own, despite this brother saying, "Let me take care of it," that they were going to take care of it because they just were envious or whatever. And that's kind of the way it got portrayed. And it was the way it looked in the film is as if both Biggie and that Biggie particularly was suspicious of this brother who was running that radio studio, just kind of nervous about Tupac's relationship with him and so forth. So that's kind of the way it got portrayed in the movie. But at the end of the day, you know, when Tupac, you know, goes with Suge, then, you know, Tupac was convinced apparently that Biggie did have something to do with it, because then some of the lyrics got pretty strong in that regard. And that's what I want to talk to you about next, is really Suge Knight. And, you know, is there anything redeemable about him?
I will say this, that the music industry, they created all of these sharks, so to speak. All of these so-called tough rappers who will shoot you, kill you, rob you, murder you, who are these super hyper masculated thugs. And when so many sharks are in the water feeding, it turns into a feeding frenzy. And sooner or later, with all that blood in the water and all those sharks, it's going to attract a killer whale. And Suge was the killer whale. He was the real deal. He was the big boy. He was the Debo, so to speak. And when the music industry created this gangbang, if you were a tough guy, you had the world in front of you in the world of hip hop at that time. And Suge was the perfect person to walk right in and take over. So I don't begrudge that to Suge. You know what I mean? They set it up for that to happen. And I will say that I grew up in the streets of the South Bronx, and I lived in Brooklyn for many years, and I participated in gangs from the Baby Spades of the Black Spades to the Zulu Nation. And I grew up with many murderers, gangbangers, and drug dealers. But I have never met as many dirty, shifty, shady characters in my life than I met in the music industry, hands down. Mm.
Whoa. Well, he comes off, Suge comes off as, this big bad brother, no question about that. And, you know, they have some pretty strong scenes in the movie about what he was willing to do. Whatnot. And, so did Tupac's music change? It seemed that it got a little bit tougher and rougher when he went with Suge. Certainly,
absolutely.
In terms of him.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because, you know, Suge's label was called Death Row, you know, and they had many gangbangers involved in the label and the music. And I would like to remind everybody that both Tupac and Biggie's murders are still unsolved, as well as Jam Master J's and Freaky Ties. And, you know, there's so many people in the rap business who are murdered, and they, you know, they never figure out who killed them. You know what I'm saying? There's a lot of money involved in hip hop. There's a lot of drugs involved in hip hop. And I would like to say a lot of people criticize Tupac's music that he made under the Death Row label. But I would like to say once again that when Tupac needed to be bailed out of jail and the cost was $1 million, the conscious community did not come together to raise $1 million to get Tupac out. Suge Knight did. So when you dance with the devil, you got to pay the piper. So Tupac owed Suge 10 albums for bailing him out for that $1 million, and he had to give Suge what he wanted. And that's what that music, sex, drugs, and rock and roll and violence, it's as American as apple pie. And America knows how to sell that very well, and it sold very well.
Well, that came through clear. You know, that part came through clear. Apparently, it showed that Dr. Dre was able to become independent and apparently without retaliation, but not so for Tupac. He felt entrapped, it seemed, that because Suge opened the books and say, you know, you've done this, but you know, here's all this stuff you have to deal with. And so, right. You know, he became a partner, so to speak. But then in that regard, became a fierce territorial defender of Death Row, at least as portrayed in the movie. And that's, you know, again, where, you know, kind of went after and it betrayed him going after Biggie, particularly, you know, in a way that was pretty, you know, dealing with his woman and a whole bunch of other stuff that, you know, is just the kind of stuff that breeds.
Absolutely.
You know, that, you know, we don't take that. Nobody takes that. I mean, you know, that's right.
I don't know if it was portrayed in the movie or not either, but a good friend of mine from here in Pittsburgh, Sam Sneed, who actually produced the song California Knows How to Party, that song for Dre and for Pac. He also tried to leave Death Row when Dre left and ran into extreme problems and got really physically abused by Suge and a bunch of his compatriots on the way out the door. So, right. Yeah, there was a lot of serious things going on when it came to criminal activity and how they actually treated people.
Now, I couldn't figure out, because I know there was a big piece in New York Times magazine recently, and I think it was about Kevin Powell, you know, having done a major, I think, was it on Tupac? I'm trying to remember now, because in the movie, much of it is about this interview that's being done, and I meant to drop Kevin Powell a note to see was that based on his interview or not, you know, with Tupac or not. Couple of other things quickly as we're running out of time. I couldn't remember, it wasn't clear, or maybe I didn't hear well, the relationship with one of Quincy Jones' daughters. It wasn't Rashida, right? It must have been another one of his daughters, but apparently this was the sort of became the love of his life as he was, you know, at the end of his days.
Wow, it was so difficult to keep up with Tupac's relationships with women. I mean,
when you see the movie, maybe you can clarify.
I'll do the research after I see the movie, but I haven't seen it yet, but I'm definitely going to see it. I mean, at one point, he even had a relationship with a good friend of mine, Heather Hunter, who used to work with me at Latin Quarters, you know what I mean? And she turned out to be one of the biggest triple X porn stars in the world.
Mm, wow, right.
So,
a lot in the movie. But I guess there are several takeaways that, from my part, because the big picture, in some respects, really still has to do with the historic, particularly in this period of disinvestment in Black America, really, you know, brothers and sisters coming together and to create, almost like we've always done, something out of nothing. Now, did it have some variants and some aspects of it that got ugly and in some ways were damaging? Yes. But on the other hand, you know, it really, the broader big picture is, you know, the way in which this society, I mean, folks had to create something. There were no jobs. It was the, you know, emergency in the community, and folks created an industry, really, and the brilliance and the genius of
of the whole thing in the depths of Tupac and Biggie is that they were both creative geniuses, and we were robbed of the opportunity to really see them be independent, have their own money, and to create the things that they wanted to create, not the things that they were forced to create because they had to eat in the industry. And I think that those are the positives I take out of it. And I would like to say that I disagree that hip-hop or anything else that we create is something out of nothing. I would always like to give credit to the creator and our ancestors. Our ancestors are the shoulders that we stood on in hip-hop. We stood on the shoulders of James Brown, George Clinton. You know, we stood on the shoulders of the great masters like Roy Ayers, and we built off of the greatness of the last poets and Muhammad Ali and the great tradition of African griots. And the first beat in hip hop was played thousands of years ago on the African drum. So we had a wealth of great masters that we studied to create hip hop and the spoken word now known as rap. And we give right. credit to our great ancestors for that.
Yeah, I'm with that, and I'm sorry, but that part, what I'm saying is, it's a different, we're speaking in different ways. I'm saying that
absolutely, sir.
In a situation, you know, where you had these, and to some degree, we still have these, what I call a state of emergency in America's dark ghettos, where there are no jobs, economic opportunities are not there, you know, the schools are bad, all of these terrible conditions, that's what I mean, out of that.
Yes, sir, I understand.
You know, folks,
and I really
went on their own.
I really wasn't responding to you.
I understand. Yeah, no, I got you.
I'm really putting out there because, you know, that's an opinion that is not really out there. You know, we see a whole lot of writers writing about hip hop and pontificating and having their opinions, and they never lived 1 minute of hip hop. But most of our history has been written by people who using hearsay and tall tales and have absolutely no facts, running around calling themselves hip hop historians and hip hop educators and things like that. So that's why we have the importance of the Universal Hip Hop Museum. And I encourage everybody to visit UHHM.org and please help us help donate and help us build this hip hop museum. And if there's any discrepancies in history, then we have an opportunity to tell our own stories, you know, organically, and allow rappers and people from the entertainment industry who were there and who created these things to tell our own stories so that we don't have these big controversies about what movie we should see and what we shouldn't see. And we have resources where we can go to fill in the gaps with actual facts.
Right. Well, I guess my final question, and I need a shorty on this, and we have to come back and talk about this more, because I guess in some ways the question is lessons learned, and you're saying that some of the same stuff is happening today as now some of the women hip-hop artists are going back and forth at each other, and it just seems that out of all of this amazing talent, you know, all of this amazing skill and genius, I mean, there's no question to see it, it's really somehow an inability to escape from, you know, to create a broader Pan-African resistance framework that binds us as opposed to having us turn on each other. I mean, it still seems to have been one of the key questions is how do we, you know, and that's a very difficult one. It's not an easy thing. So
yes,
I'm not
sir.
Talking out in any romantic way, but
yes, sir.
It's a question of how to take all of this raw creative genius and talent and meld it in a way that it becomes a force for liberation in our community in a way that it has to some degree, but in a way that would be, I mean, given this could be the basic, really the foundation for really uplifting and just moving the Black community forward in a major, major, major way.
Absolutely. We have to find a functional unity that is worldwide with our brothers and sisters, and we have to be more independent. We have to do business with each other. We have to stop relying on the rap industrial complex, the same ones who are heavily invested in the prison industrial complex to control the flow of our music. You know what I mean? The same people who control the music business, the radio stations, the video companies, the movies, are the same people who are heavily invested in the prison industrial complex. And we've allowed them to criminalize our children, and we've allowed them to change the narrative of our great music to nothing but sex, violence, and drugs, and murder. And we definitely need a great functional unity that you speak of in order to turn that around.
All right, well, let's keep working on the project. Again, Paradise Gray, appreciate you being with us. Our resident expert on all things hip-hop, because I don't know nothing. I'm still sitting at your feet, brother, trying to learn and to learn more and more and to share your wisdom and knowledge with our audience. So thanks much. We'll have to bring you back in the near future.
And I stand on your shoulders, and I learn something from you every single day. Thank you so much for the incredible work that you do, and thank you for having me on. God bless you.
All right. Thank you so much. All right. We're going to take a brief pause, and we'll be back with Earl Ofari Hutchinson discussing Bill Maher took license to, you know, use the N-word. Are we paying too much attention to it? We'll be right back after this break.
Today it just got bigger.
But I ain't no black leader. Not yet.
And how you not a black leader? The vice president was just talking about you on the TV. Baby, you have to understand. With the Panthers, it wasn't that we had guns or black leather. It was because of our message. We were transforming minds. They are gonna come after you with everything you love. They gonna give you the tools that you need to destroy yourself.
It's happened to you.
What happened to me? I got shot 5 times. That's what happened to me. What happened to you? You used to be damn.
It's stupid. And it's dangerous.
It's dangerous getting shot too.
The man I knew wanted to use his voice to educate. To bring people together.
If he coming at me, he gonna get dealt with.
So can't nobody tell you nothing, huh? Huh?
Not about this.
Okay.
Jaden! Why the cameras all on me? And in the report and all these charges, I didn't do nothing. I'm charged with being in concert with some guys. Well, where they at? Why me? Because I'm Tupac? No, I'm not angry at them. I'm angry at the system. I don't want nobody else to go to jail, you know what I'm saying? But I don't want to go to jail for something I didn't do. I just don't want to be the scapegoat. You know what I'm saying? It's like the only way I know how to live my life is to be responsible for what I do.
I wrote something for you. You are the omega of my heart, the foundation for my conception of love. When I think of what a black woman should be, it's you that I first think of. You will never fully understand how deeply my heart feels for you. I worry that we'll grow apart and I'll end up losing you. You bring me to climates without sex, and you do it all with regal grace. You are my heart in human form, a friend I can never replace.
Okay, we're back, and we hope you enjoyed that nice music. Compliments of our chief announcer, Michael G. Haskins, and those clips from the excerpts from the movie, the film that's out in theaters. Now, we do urge you to go see it because we don't want these films to fail. The legendary Tupac Shakur, All Eyes on Me, as I reported yesterday when I went to the theater to see it because I wanted to have Paradise Way of X-Clan on today to talk about the film. I was frankly disappointed because when I got to the theater, I was the only one for a minute, and then gradually the count got up to 14 in a theater that easily holds about 300 people. So I understand it's done reasonably well, but it certainly is worth seeing, and it was worth seeing for me simply because it was educational to know more about Tupac and whatnot. So anyway, we encourage you, and we'll be talking about that. We're going to have a big chunk of the show today to have you call in online. Sorry, we're taking a little time getting to Earl of Harry Hutchinson, no fault of his own, but we had some issues we had to resolve, but we finally got through to my main man, Earl O'Farrie Hutchinson, who's all things to all folk all the time, including having his own big-time radio show and streaming live all on CNN, MSNBC, and all that stuff. I'm an elder now, so I can't say I'm kind of going to be like you because there ain't enough time left. But, hey, brother.
Well, you know what, Ron? Yes, there is, because I got to tell you, we're close to the same age, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying you're so far ahead. It's like, you're out there, so that's really good. But, look, I always appreciate you taking time to be on. I look at your stuff. We posted on the IBW website.
I know. I'm honored.
Many things that come across, but I particularly saw this piece on Bill Maher. I didn't actually see the Bill Maher show. I saw the subsequent controversy to some degree and the discussion about it, but it reignited this sort of perennial discussion about the N-word, who can use it, when, and on what circumstances, or if ever. And you wrote a piece about it, so that was the pretext for me giving you a call and saying, let's hear what Earl has to say about it.
Well, you mentioned just a couple of seconds ago about the movie Tupac, and I guess that's a good segue into this discussion about the perennial N-word. Now, Bill Maher, he does use it. He said it was a joke. Can't you take a joke? HBO censored him for it. They said, no, Bill, you can't do that. He apologized profusely. He's been doing mea culpas all over the place since then. But, you know, it really raised a bigger question. Forget him for a second. The bigger question that I zeroed in on, and I've done this before. It's not the first time. You know, Ron, I can almost recycle this piece simply because from time to time, just like, the seasons change, you can count on the N-word, something coming up about that. It's perennial. If you have a situation where you have the rappers, the comedians, us, far too many of us, casually and cavalierly just kind of encode that word in our language, sanctify it, all the things that we've heard about, the term of endearment, we take the sting out of it, and on and on and on. We've heard all of that. Then when, say, a Bill Maher or a politician or a radio talk show host, or a racist of any stripe, when they use that term, why are you getting all bent out about it? The fact of the matter is, we know, Ron, that every ethnic group, be it Jews, be it Italians, be it Irish, be it Hispanics, be it Puerto Ricans, be it any nationality or ethnic group, yes, they have in-house words, pejorative words that they use about themselves and among themselves, but there's a major, major difference. The major difference is we, as a people, far too many African Americans, have put that word out there, have sanctified that word in the popular culture. So quite naturally, when you have young whites, when you have young Hispanics, when you have young anybody, just anywhere on the planet, casually using the word, tossing it around, well, it's in the culture. You've kind of put the imprimatur on it. You put the stamp of approval on it. And so now we come back to Brother Bill. him using the word. And by the way, did you notice something else, Ron? What I picked up on is not so much Bill using the word. What I picked up on was when he used the word or the term, then the reaction of the audience. Oh, they went wild. They laughed about it. They saw nothing wrong with it. My guess is in that audience, it was probably like little United Nations. So what are we talking about when we talk about this N-word? What are we talking about when you go after, say, a white guy that uses it inappropriately? But the fact is, you've done it, put it in the culture. You know, you put the stamp on it. It's okay to use, but then you get bent out about it. I guess I'm puzzled by the logic of that, Ron.
Well, let me just say this, too, because I was interested in knowing what your position was on it. But then, again, I didn't get a chance to you know, I often see Bill Maher, though I don't, sometimes I'm just flipping channels and catch him at night. It's not something that I sort of dedicate myself to seeing every week or whatever. But I usually, there are times when I get to see the original or the replay. Then I heard that Michael Eric Dyson went on, as well as Ice Cube. And then I said to myself, Ice Cube? And I talked to Charlie about this. I said to myself yesterday, I said, well, what position could Ice Cube have taken? And somebody said, well, he told Bill Maher, hey, man, you can't use that term. And I'm saying myself with NWA, I mean, when I critique this N-word, one of the things that I put out there is just your, it's amazing how much we think alike on many of these issues. My critique is exactly that. You know, I mean, like, would Jews have a term, and I won't want to use the term on the air, but there's a certain word with an attitude, or Italians with an attitude, would any of their artists, any of their people put that out there like that? If, you see what I'm saying? But here is Ice Cube and them, their whole group was named that, and I understand why they named it that. But in so doing, they put it out there.
Yes,
and on my block, where we have now, you know, it's a neighborhood that was predominantly a black neighborhood, it's shifted, you know, dramatically to where there are fewer and fewer black people and the Caribbeans and so forth, mostly Latinos. And these are, and they're good people. You know, the young brothers, you know, I call them brothers, and, you know, and on the block, and they were out just the other day, right in front of my stoop, you know, they pulled up the table between, there are two or three houses together, put the dominoes out, and they were slamming dominoes. And almost every other word.
Every other
the
word.
N-word.
Yep.
Every other word. And if I step to them and try to say, well, I don't want to hear it, they wouldn't understand what I'm talking about. They don't mean any harm. They don't mean any harm by that.
That's the point. You know, it's been put out there in the popular culture. It's been accepted. And, you know, and then let's take it a step further. Let's do a what if for a second. Ron, you mentioned Ice Cube. You know, you mentioned NWA. And, you know, there are a number of groups like that that feasted on the N-word. They profited off of that. And record companies, producers. I mean, it's big money in the use of those pejorative terms and words. Could you imagine for a second? Let's talk to Ice Cube. So, Ice, let me ask you this. Cube, let me ask you this. Suppose you had the idea of going in the studio and using a pejorative in your rap stuff and using a pejorative about Jews. Number one, do you think the record would be produced? Number two, do you think it would have any chance of being distributed if produced? And number three, do you think you'd ever work again? Let me ask you that, IQ. Let me ask you that. And maybe I can add a number. Let me add a number four to that, too. I got news for you. I can answer all three of them, and the answer is a flat no. But there's a fourth thing, too. You wouldn't even entertain the idea of doing that, not because you're not going to work again, not because you're going to be ostracized, not because you're going to be run out of the business, because you already know there's no market for that. There would be no market for that. Now, we're talking dollars and cents now, and the producers know there would be no market for that. However, you know, the producers know, the record companies know, the industry knows. There's a huge growth industry in that. It's profitable to use that. So we got a double thing going here, a triple thing. The culture, you put the stamp of approval on it, number one. The second thing is you'd be run out of Dodge. Number two, if you try to use another pejorative for another group, and we know what that group is. And number three, it's sanctified in the industry, because there's a really a good kind of osmosis between you and the producers. You guys know what can make money and what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable.
Well, yeah, it is, you know, it is, again, when I heard Cube, and by the way, I think that Ice Cube, you know, has certainly, you know, a lot of these, it's interesting, and we were having this discussion with Paradise Gray, because a lot of these rappers have really, you know, came out of their roots. It really speaks to the tremendous genius in the Black community, and I don't say that with any sense of racial chauvinism, because it's embedded in all groups. You know, I was looking at a piece the other day. I didn't get a chance to see the whole thing, but it was about someone who went to a rural area in Mississippi to teach people how to play chess. And so there were some Black people there too, but there were a couple of young white kids saying, yeah, they didn't think that, I forget how they mentioned it, they were classifying themselves. They didn't think that Southerners or that hillbillies, or they didn't, I forget what the term was, could play chess. Well, of course they can play chess. human beings are intelligent, you know what I mean? And if they have an opportunity, human beings will shine at whatever it is, you know. So I'm not trying to corner a genius in the Black community, but it does show that, you know, for all of the horrible stories and all of the horrible conditions, you know, we have incredible talent. And that talent was reflected in much of the music and the art of hip hop, and that these guys, you know, Cube and them have sort of transformed themselves now into more positive models. You know, they're doing films and producing this and producing that, and you know, and I think that's not a bad thing. Unfortunately, along the way, you know, the genre did create some damage, you know, in terms of, I think, right, in terms of, you know, the misogynist lyrics, the realness, which, you know, was so raw and negative that, you know, it had, you know, some ways embedded and deeply, more deeply ingrained in our consciousness and in our sense of pain, these ideas. But I do want to give them credit for, you know, they've morphed now. They're now morphing and try to do different things and whatever. I just wanted to get that out of the way. But on the other hand, and like you say, it may be too late to get this thing back in the model, but these apologists for it, well, we can take the sting out of it. We can make it positive and all that kind of stuff. Well, you would not hear Jews, Italians, other groups saying that. I mean, they just wouldn't say that. I don't mean to take the sting out of it. No. It is a derogatory term. It has its history. It has its background. And that's the kind of thing that people should seem to be focusing on.
Well, and then there's something else, Ron. So when we had the discussion on one of my shows, here was the challenge to the audience. Now, every caller that called in, they savaged Bill Maher. They went after him. They went after, you know, all the racists that used the word. They talked about the word, the history of it, the negativism of it, what's associated with the pain and suffering. In other words, the whole nine yards on the word. But I had to stop people. I said, okay, we got that. Let's take a little bit further. Let's take the conversation with you a little bit further than that. You don't like the word. You rail against it. You rail against it even when Blacks use it. And I'm talking to Blacks now. I want to ask you this. When you hear someone use a term that's Black, I said Black, when you hear an African-American or someone of African ancestry, especially African-American, no matter what age they may be, use the term, especially if you're a teacher and educator in the schools, do you stop that young person and say, let me tell you something, we don't use this word. I don't allow this word. I don't care what you do out of earshot, but with me, no. And here's why I don't allow that word. And give them a little history lesson. Do you routinely do that? So I know if you don't do that, you know, don't come on here and tell me about you don't like Bill using it. You don't like the racist white guy using it. You don't like somebody in the GOP using it. You don't like any of them. I'm not interested in that. I can't stop what they do. They're going to do what they do. What I do have control over is what I do and what you do as a people. So do you do that routinely? Do you fulfill your role as a historic transmitter of positive values and ideas, culture, and our experience by giving just that little mini little lecture to that individual Black that uses that word? Now, they may keep using it, but you give them something to think about. Do you do that? I couldn't get an affirmative answer on that, Ron, from too many people.
Well, yeah, because it's like now it's almost like going up, it's almost like it's like an uphill battle. You know what I mean? It is so much out there, and so it's to me it's painful when I hear the word "is pain." I mean, I cringe when I hear it being used. But by the way, I don't use it even internally. I have made the decision that I just many years ago I did. And by the way, and my son and I were having this conversation last night. Frankly, there is a structure to, for lack of a better term, black language, black vernacular. You can call it Ebonics, I don't care what you call it. There is a way in which we enter, and by the way, those who are teaching linguistics have worked on this. I had a friend who taught at the University of Pittsburgh. He specialized in this whole thing. And he would show the language patterns, between certain language groups and how we use language, like people think that just because we say, he bad, that we just use in bad language. But he would want to go and he would show the equivalent in Europe and where they say him bad. You know what I mean? Because been, and beyond that, this is just as in the Caribbean people created Creole and other various, the out of the interaction of different languages created their own language systems and ways of acting and doing things. We similarly have that. So with us, intonation, tone, how it's used means everything. I can use the word one way and mean it's positive. I can use it another way and you're ready to fight because that by the way I said it, the way I emphasized it or whatever, I meant negative. And that's an internal kind of thing. But still, even at that, I just decided years ago, I just stopped saying the word, period, because I just think that it was just destructive for us to use it once I learned more myself. And whatever, but it is such a difficult thing now because it is, and it's painful because we've allowed others, as you said before, we've given them the sort of the right to use it. Earl, can you hang with me a few more minutes because I had difficulties. I want to talk about this Democratic primary tomorrow, a couple of other quick subjects. Can you give me 10 more minutes?
No problem.
I got to take a break here. We're trying to also make a shift here and some things. So hang on. We're going to take a break here. Be right back with Earl Ofari Hutchinson here on Vantage Point.
One thing I got out of it was magic I like to share with you. It's like I was leaving and I was sitting in the hotel and a voice said to me, he said, look around. What do you see? And I said, I see all colors of people doing everything, And the voice said, do you see any niggas? And I said, no. And I said, you know why? Because there aren't any. And it hit me like a shot, man. I started crying and shit. Yeah, I've been here 3 weeks. I haven't even said it. I haven't even thought it. And it made me say, oh, my God, I've been wrong. I've been wrong. I got to regroup my shit. I said, I ain't gonna never call another black man a nigger.
Listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio and online at WBAI.org.
The role of media in a democratic society should be to empower people to make decisions.
WBAI, speaking truth to power for over 50 years.
You have very few powerful media outlets that are actually doing the two things that I think are the most central aims of good journalism, which is to give voice to the voiceless and hold those in power accountable.
WBAI, your community alternative.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale. On Tuesday, June 20th, my guest on EcoLogic will be meteorologist Tom Weissmuller, who will predict this summer's weather and hurricane season and explain how El Niños and La Niñas in the western Pacific Ocean and storms in the western Sahara Desert will affect our weather. That's Tuesday, June 20th at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Chloe Glickman, and I'm an intern at WBAI. Looking to get professional experience doing something you're actually passionate about? At WBAI, I'm able to develop skills in journalism, marketing, event planning, editing, social networking, and much more, all while working directly with producers and the management team. BAI is always taking applications for credit and non-credit internships, so get in touch today. Send an email to internships@wbai.org for more information. Join the team that supplied New York with independent radio for over 50 years. Help keep community radio going strong.
Yes. Montana, right? Well, actually, let me walk it back a second, Ron. Montana and Kansas. Yes, they're deep red states on the surface, but they're changing in the sense that I have to remind people in Montana that that race was winnable there. The fact of the matter is people think that, well, you know, it's all GOP. No, it's not. You have a number of local elected officials in Montana in small cities and towns. Most of them are that anyway. They're Democrats. You have a senator, a sitting senator that's a Democrat. The governor of the state is a Democrat. So, you know, the problem is when you have a party at the national level or the local level that concedes anything. That's why I liked Howard Dean in his 50-state, you know, answer to the party. He said, look, we shouldn't concede anything. You know, obviously we have priorities of where we're going to put our resources. I mean, you're not going to try to be all things to all people. But you have to have a presence there. You have to have an opposition there. You have to make an effort there. And I think in Montana, when they looked at it, the Democrats were shocked how close they came with almost no effort. And so that should have been a signal. Look, you've got to do, Ron, we have been in politics long enough to know it's not about celebrity endorsements. It's not about fancy, expensive TV ads. It's about boots on the ground. Politics 101, basic stuff, not rocket scientists. What does that mean? It means you got to have the volunteers, first of all. You've got to go door to door, talk to the voters, tell them why they should vote against somebody else, but why they should vote for you. You've got to work the early registration votings. A lot of people vote early. You know, 30 to 45% of the people vote before election day. You know, you've got to have the phone banks. You've got to work social media. You've got to put the boots on the ground all over the place. I mean, come on, this is not rocket scientist stuff. The GOP learned from the devastating defeat in 2008 and 2012, what the Obama organization did, taking care of, paying attention to all the nuts and bolts of political education, registration, mobilization, paying attention to your base, getting them out there. And we come to Georgia now. What bothered me about Georgia, at least in the primary, that was a winnable race. Two problems I saw. A big deal was made, Ron, that John Ossoff, the candidate there, the Democratic candidate, young guy, politically savvy, you know, I mean, he's on the point on a lot of issues, but a lot of the money came in from outside. They raised an incredible amount of money, but it came from outside. I want to know what's coming from inside. I want to know, you know, the nickels and dimes from local people in that district. I want to know about the volunteers. I want to know about exactly the nuts and bolts of how you're running this campaign, the door-to-door stuff that you need to do to win an election. I want to know that. You cannot go down there in any district and think Trump is going to win an election for you because people are just so terrorized of him, they're going to come out and vote for you. That doesn't work that way. You cannot think because the GOP appears to be so disorganized and, you know, are on the wrong side of all these issues that you claim to, you think they are anyway, that it's going to work for you. There was a piece the other day, Ron, about African-American voters in that district. They make up about 13% of the district. And they were interviewing many of them. And many of them were saying, you know what? We not only did we not know there was an election, and many of them didn't even bother voting in the primary, but the other thing about it is we haven't had a knock on our door at all from the campaign. Now, they're correcting that in the last few days. They're getting out there, making an outreach, the All South campaign, the Democratic Party. They're putting the volunteers out there, and they're specifically going after African-American voters. Is it too late? I don't know. We'll know on Tuesday. But beyond Tuesday, what concerns me, Ron, there is a fair chance in 2018 of at least being competitive, taking many seats back in the House. I don't think the Senate is up for play, not in 2018. 2020, yes. But I think certainly the House is. And there are about 25 districts, as we well know, that are certainly in play. If, in fact, and I'm looking at Tuesday to see how the Democrats perform, not whether they win or not, but how they perform if they win or even if they lose. If, in fact, there's a ground game there, Perez and Ellison are really doing the work, and I think they are, you know, really building the party infrastructure locally again, then I think there's a fair chance that, you know, the House would be Democratic. And then if we do that in 2018, we can roll through 2020 and keep checking this guy all the way till we can get him out of there. So that's really our only hope at this point. Right. Absolutely. Right. Is local. Yeah. Well, you know, Ron, let me say this too. You're in New York. I'm in California. I mean, come on, Ron. New York and California, you can pretty much be as progressive as you want, you know, in many districts, you know, in New York and California. You already know going in, your progressivism is not a liability. You know, people are on, by and large, in many of those districts on the same page with you. But now we come to a Montana. We come to a Kansas. We come to Georgia, this suburban district outside of Atlanta. You know, John Ossoff, on that point you just made, here's something very specific. He made it clear, I cannot go in there as I could in New York in many districts or in California and talk single payer. We need and I want and I'm going to fight for single payer. I can't do that. People aren't there. What I can do, I can go there and I can talk about the need to protect, maybe strengthen, maybe work out some tweaks, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. I'm going to fight to preserve that and expand that and all that. You know, people can identify with that. But if I'm going in there talking right away single payer, even though I agree, you know, I want that, I like that, we need that, you know, this is not France. This is not Britain. This is not Canada. People have not been educated. They've not been brought to that level yet. So just like you said before, Ron, you've got to, man, we don't disagree. We very much agree. You've got to not only match the candidate with the district, you've also got to match their ideology, their approach to politics, and their approach to people with that district. If you don't do that, you're not going to win. You're just spinning your wheels.
Mm-hmm. And a large numbers of liberals in the party. It had that kind of diversity, right? Which means in certain districts, I remember the Affordable Care Act debate. You know, there was a district up in Michigan where in order to get one of the Democrats on board, they had to soften the position of abortion.
Right. Yes. Right. Talking about basically a neo-fascist party. That's what you're talking about. And, you know, back to the point, though, about matching up individuals, ideology, districts, and so forth, there's another problem, too, that the Democratic Party, quite frankly, they have to face. And you're absolutely right. On the worst day, Ron, a blue dog Democrat, a Democrat, is far better than any Republican, almost any, on their worst day. But having said that, the fight within the Democratic Party, there is a serious issue here that we well know. You've got the Obama, Clinton, basically very moderate, very centrist, very corporate-oriented Democrats, and you've got the Bernie wing. You've got the progressives, and they're big, they're huge, and they're growing, and they're influential. Now, what I'm really looking at, and what could be problematic, hopefully not, how do you merge these two together? There's got to be a coming together, a meeting of the minds. How does that happen? And again, I don't have an answer to that, you know, at this point, but I just know this. If we don't find an answer, the Democratic Party doesn't find an answer, the golden opportunity that they have in 2018 with that House could go down the tubes. I hope I'm wrong. I hope I'm dead wrong. But I hope, you know, Ellison, I hope Perez, now to the powers that be within the Democratic National Committee and the local, the state and the local committees find an answer to that quickly. Well, you know, it's always a pleasure, Ron. You know, stay strong, keep up the good work. Take care now.
All right, we're back. I was making an announcement about the reparations march that's coming up this Saturday with the People Organizations for Progress. Larry Hamm was on with us last week. It will begin at 12 o'clock noon at the Lincoln Monument, I think it is, and it will be focused on really getting everybody within the New Jersey delegation to be co-sponsors on H.R. 40. That is the reparations repair bill, remedy bill. So for further information, you can call Larry Hamm, Chairman Larry Hamm, at 973-801-0001. And I'll talk also about the fact that, of course, we have the great International African Arts Festival coming up, the 28th Annual Symposium on Culture, Community, and Struggle. There are many, many, many speakers, but I got to just shout out to Dr. Rosalind Jeffries. You know, there is a better half than Dr. J. You got to go hear Dr. Rosalind, and she will be the keynote speaker for the symposium. It's 10 o'clock a.m. to 4:30 p.m., and it's right across the street from where the actual event is held. And that is at 50 Navy Street in Brooklyn, between Flushing Avenue and Brooklyn Navy Yard. So for further information, you can also give them a call. I'll find the number. I'll be sure to announce it again during the course of the show. I don't see a number immediately, but we certainly want to. That is one of the great events that we have in our community every year. We certainly want to give them a tremendous amount of support. Number 718-789-3264, 718-789-3264. Again, many, many speakers, but the one I want to hear is Dr. Roslyn Jeffries, and that is on July 1st. Okay, let's go to our listening audience. We have, again, a few minutes, more minutes than we usually have to discuss the critical issues that we talked about today, particularly either Tupac or the N-word. Let's go to our first caller. Good morning. Welcome to Vantage Point.
Hello.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Well, good morning. I'm Trey, calling from right now Rockland County, formerly Bronx resident. And I want to get on both of them. The N-word thing, I hear it so often upstate. I mean, more than you would think. And it's not, quote-unquote, said in a hostile way. It's said in a liberal Bill Maher way, as in, hey, I'm one of you guys. I can say the N-word. We're cool. And I'm fed up with it. And I believe that rap in its entirety is a big proponent of this crap going on now. So many young Caucasian kids have grown up listening to these songs, and they feel like it's okay. It's okay. And these young rappers that are at their concerts, and the concerts are filled with Caucasian kids because kids of their color can't even afford the shows, and they're screaming back and forth the same words, back and forth, and this, and that, and then the young kids are screaming it, and this, and that. So when they out on the streets and they see somebody black, and they like, yo, my N, and the young kid is like, hey, like, it's okay. And I'm looking at the teenager, the black youth, I'm looking at them, and there's nothing in their eyes. It's nothing there. It's dead there. Because they're saying the word so much, it means nothing to them.
Right.
So
right.
On that, I've thrown my hands up because I'll be grabbing a lot of people's kids if I enforced it on a daily basis. Okay.
Right.
Now moving right along to Tupac. That brother there was a revolutionary born. Okay. When you listen to Changes, when you listen to Dear Mama, it says it all. He was well thought out. He was an introvert. So even when he was in the crowd, he was known to be quiet because his mind was constantly clicking. And to think of who that brother might have become if he was allowed to age and mature and develop, it breaks my heart. It breaks my heart.
Right. Well, it's good to have your perspective on that because, like you said, he was at only 25 years old. And we've seen how Ice Cube has matured. We've seen how Snoop has matured. We've seen how some of these folks have actually matured. And I don't think any of them, I don't really know, but it's possible that none of them would have, that Tupac would have surpassed all of them, you know, had he had a little bit more.
None of them had songs like him at that time. At 25, even though he had gangster songs, he also had social songs, he had political songs, he was conscious at 25. So,
right.
Like you said, if those other brothers was able to move along and get to where they are right now, coming from where they were at, you think about where Tupac was at, where he would be at this point, politically, socially. And it's the, you know, sometimes it's like the losses we have suffered as a people. When every time we get a God in light, it gets snuffed out. And I'm just going to leave it there. Thank you, brother.
All right. Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate your call. Others can also give us a call. Again, 347-335-0818. That's 347-335-0818. We're focusing really our comments on two subjects. Tupac Shakur, was he a revolutionary? And again, this whole question of the use of the N-word that was precipitated again, not the first time we've heard this debate by Bill Maher. And he was chastised really severely by by Ice Cube, and I don't know what position Michael Eric Dyson took. I suspect he may have taken a similar position that, you know, you can't, it's internal, and therefore should not be used externally, except the fact of the matter is, it is widely being used, and I don't know whether there's anything we can do about it at this stage, but it does, personally, it chagrins me deeply. But I want to hear your position, so call us at 347, again, 335-0818. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello. I'm Tom from the Bronx here, and the evil N-word. If you look at a map of Africa, there's Algeria, Nigeria, and northeast of Nigeria, there's a country called Niger, N-I-G-E-R. That was the first country where people were kidnapped from for slavery. My guess is that individuals that were brought to the Americas from Niger were asked by ignorant fools, where do you come from? Where do you come from? And these poor souls must have said, I come from Niger, Niger. And these louts went and added an extra G to the word of Niger. So when you add an extra G, what do you get?
Well, you get the contemporary N-word or the historical negative N-word, right?
Yeah, well, you get that hideous N-word that comes out of there, and that's how it evolved, in my opinion.
Right.
That's how that evolved.
Right. Well, and, certainly it bears some study. There's also the word negro, which in Spanish and Portuguese means black, but also is a negative. So it is likely that it could well have been a perversion of that as well.
Well,
what we do know,
yeah.
What we do know is the history of it in relationship to lynchings and killings and the brutality that is associated with it is such that, you know, actually many, many people have felt that it ought not to be sanctified, it ought not to be normalized, because it emerged as a pejorative negative term in terms of black history and culture.
Yes, that was where I got that from, too, was that in Look magazine years ago, A Life, had the story of the first people that were kidnapped from Africa, and it was in Niger. See, that's where I thought of this story. Many years ago, I read that. It was either in Look or Life.
Right, right, right. Well, I'm not up on my... I mean, I taught Introduction to African History and so forth, and certainly How Europe Developed Africa by Walter Rodney has some of that history as well. So we do know that the first came from the interior, and whether it was Niger or into Congo or whatever, but, you know, we know that the first Africans were captured, enslaved in the interior of Africa, and certainly Niger is a country which is not a coastal country, to be sure. Anyway, look, appreciate very much your call. Others can call us at 347-335-0818. Again, the topics under discussion are the legacy of Tupac Shakur. Was he a revolutionary? Our first caller called in and really, you know, shared his thoughts about that. We had Paradise Gray, the co-founder of X-Clan, on earlier, discussing that, but also the controversy about the N-word and the degree to which it has become so widely used. Our first caller talking about concerts in which the artists on the stage are saying it, and then the audience, predominantly white students, white audience goers, are shouting it back. I mean, goodness gracious, to me, but what it speaks to is a lack of consciousness or a different sense of consciousness on the part of the hip-hop artists. I would think that they're not even doing it negatively. They're not even doing it maliciously. They don't even see it as harmful. And I don't quite grasp, given the discussion and debate that's been had about it, how that could be, except perhaps an internal breakdown in terms of a sense of how the elders see it and a new generation sees it. But on the other hand, that's not either new either. Because there was a time when you know, young people began to do gospel, and the elders didn't like gospel. They thought it was devil music. And, you know, at the end of the day, frankly, the younger generation over time prevailed. So it could be that maybe some of us are just out of sync, you know. I'm not sure we are. I hope we're not. But that could very, very well be the case. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
How are you doing, Ron? This is Curtis.
Yes.
Okay. Well, the term, it really comes from the term we use from ancient times. It's called the Nagas. All right. And this is the people that was, that they come from the Druids. So, it preceded, Nigeria and Niger. However, a lot of people has not been educated on the origin of the term. Now with that said, you mentioned something about you think people don't mean no harm by the word, but my thing is I don't think they mean any healing either. You know, a lot of it is come from the callousness and the unconcern of how it affects, you know, others when they lash out. You know, this callousness it can be cultural, it can be habitual. Because it's been kicked around so much that a lot of people really don't even know where the term stems from. However, my thing is on the callousness of it, when they spew it. And then there's other cases where when you have, this interracial dating going on, such as Bill Morris, I think I heard him, people saying that he used to date black women, you know, and so he may have thought he was being cute, you know, when using it, because if Chris Rock would have said it in the same context, it would have been hilarious to some people, you know. But he dated black females, so he may had a certain feeling on just, you know, just allowing the word to be used. And I like for people to recognize that although we may think that, okay, we overcame when it comes to this interracial stuff, there's other people that really, they still see us as that, you know. And it'd be interesting of how Serena Williams would feel when the guy that she married just blurts it out. Because it just happens, you know. It just happens, you know. Whether they, you know, whether they really contemplated on what they said, but a lot of times, emotional things will lead to words coming out, and that's a word that comes out in different cases, Ron. You know.
Let me ask you this, because what happens sometimes is, you know, if we were having a conversation between you and the two of us, or maybe a group of us in the barbershop, there's a way in which we know if we were using the word, and I just don't use it anymore, but I know when we used it, and not only that, it could be swear words, whatever it is, there were a way in which you said it earlier, the tone, how it's said, sometimes determines what the intent is. Because, you know, I mean, there was a whole thing about, you know, you mind if you ain't don't get no bigger. You know what
right.
I mean? Well, that's not, that's internal. Nobody meant that negatively. On the other hand, you say something else in a different tone, and that says that you mean intentions. The problem is that, like the earlier brother talked about the concerts, those white people who are responding to the artists on the stage, the artist on the stage is giving them sanction to participate in saying this back. So in a way, they're saying, well, if you say it's all right, then it must be all right. Because in a way, you take your cues from the oppressed group. For example, I don't say certain things. I really have struggled hard not to say things that are offensive to other groups. I've tried to listen hard to how groups want to be called and how they want to be, so I can be in accord with that. So if they give me permission to say something negative and that's okay, then I'm not sure I would do it anyway, but nonetheless.
Anyway.
You know, that's one of the big problems we face is that, you know, like I said, on my block, these young Latino kids, and I know they don't mean any harm. You know, I've spoken to them on Trump. No,
I
don't think.
Carry on, bro.
No, I mean, because what they're doing is they're calling each other it. You know what I mean? they're not just talking to black people. They're internally speaking to each other. They greet each other with the N-word. And then some people said there's a difference between the, you know, the N-A and the N-A-H, and they got all these permutations. To me, you know, generationally, and, you know, that this may be the case, it's all bad for me. But on the other hand,
for you,
I just don't know what to do about it, to be honest about it. I don't know. I can.
This is what I've done one time, Ron, because I don't use it either. I don't use it anymore. I did at one time, Ron. Yes, I did. You know, and when I heard Richard Pryor back then, I mean, it really gave me a reason to really dig what comes out of my mouth, my brother. Now, this is what I did on the train one time, because it used to sicken me also, but I recognize that a lot of times when we get fed up or intolerant of another person's actions or what a person says, a lot of time it comes out of our own disgust of what we used to say and how we used to be, in so many cases. And we see it. We see the ugliness of it and say, dang, I used to be like that. And so it brings about a certain reaction. But this is what I did on the train one time when it just kicked around one time. I said, let me see how these people, if they really mean any harm or any good. And they was kicking it back and forth. I was on the D train. There's a lot of Hispanic. And they was kicked back and forth. The group, they was loud and boisterous. And so I had my earphones on as if I was reciting a song. And I used the S word. If you know where I'm coming from. I don't get a kick out of being offensive either. So you know what I'm saying, though. I said, blah, blah, blah. And you're stupid, blah, blah, blah. And a couple of people looked, because the train was full of them. And these characters turned around and looked, and then every time they went on to continue talking, and every time the word would come out, I was, and you did it, you know, and I spit it out again.
Yeah, that was interesting.
And so now, eventually, they softened their tone when they used it. They used it less, and other people was looking at them. They was looking at me. I felt the anger towards me by others, the females and everything, because of the word, you know. But then they knew where it was coming from, and then he was looking at them. It just gave them a reason to really dig themselves, because eventually, before I got off the train, my brother, guess what? They stopped. I took a risk.
Interesting experiment. Look, thanks much. Really appreciate your call. All right, others can call it 347-335-0818. That's an interesting experience, you know, if you would do that. I mean, this younger generation, how many of them are even conscious of what the internal negative terms are in, you know, let's say the Jewish community, Spanish community, Italian community? That's interesting in and of itself. But that's an interesting experiment. Somebody is saying the N-word, you coming back with the S-word, I mean, back and forth. And then people start saying, oh, whoa, you know, that's a thought provoker in terms of maybe a way of learning, if you will. Again, others can call at 347-335-0818. Don't forget, this coming Saturday, the 24th, the big reparations march is going to be taking place 12 o'clock noon, gathering at the Lincoln Monument and then marching throughout the downtown of Newark, New Jersey, coming back. That's the Lincoln statue, which is West Market Street and Springfield Avenue. And then, of course, they'll march and then come back, you know, to have the rally. And again, that's the powerful people's organization for progress. And the goal is to organize and mobilize around H.R. 40. And you can call Larry Hamm at 973-801-0001 to get further information. We want a strong turnout, you know, for that event. And, of course, July 1st also, the coming up, the 28th Annual Symposium on Culture, Community, and Struggle, 10 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., International African Art Expresso. But that's one of the things I look forward to every year. They've kept this alive, kept it going, and this is the intellectual knowledge-sharing part of it. And Dr. Rosalind Jeffries will be the keynote speaker for that event. And again, we want everybody to come and attend. 718-789-3264, 718-789-3264. All right, let's go back to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Hello.
Hello, how are you this morning?
Morning.
I'm okay. Okay, good morning. My name is Gina. I'm in Manhattan calling.
Okay.
About the N-word.
Yes.
A few years ago, I was used to ride on the subway. I still ride. And whenever I heard people using that word, especially like younger people, people younger than me, I would say something, you know, like, to be out of respect, you know, I would say just, you know, I'm just coming to you in total respect, but a lot of people suffered under using that word, and you should consider not using it. And what I noticed is that a lot of the younger men, they would stop. But what I found is that sometimes the younger women had a problem. Sometimes they were very resistant, especially there was one person who said she grew up in the housing project, and I told her, so did I. But she was totally resistant. I mean, she even followed me as I got off the subway. I mean, it really got pretty bad. What I feel isn't so good is that comedians are now able to make a lot of commentary that is really taken as, you know, gospel.
Right.
And there was one comedian that I love. I don't know if I should say his name, but...
No, you don't have to.
Can I? Okay. So his comedy is really radical and on point. He used to write with Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
But his take on that word, I really didn't think was such a good idea because it leaves out so much of the history. And I think now in society, it's very expedient in how we look at things. You know, we don't get too deep into the history of many things, you know, how we dress, what we say, you know, and the N-word is a good example. So just a common everyday example, like what you decided where someone has a concert and they shout that word. There's a consciousness now where it's no depth, there's no review of what is being said or done. It's just someone says it and then everyone says it without any review of it. And it's pretty bad.
Yeah, it is pretty bad. And it seems to be a degeneration of, and I'm not sure about this, so I always hesitate about sort of the views of the elders in the community. It's almost like, you know, y'all don't count. You know, what y'all are saying about this.
Yeah.
We don't care what you're saying about this. We heard what you're saying. We are, you know, because if you look at what's happening in terms of police brutality and stop and frisk and all of that, I mean, it's a way in which people are looked at in a certain way. You know what I mean? This white supremacy looks at people a certain way. They look at people with the symbol, the M concept in their minds, if you will. And I don't know that gets conveyed in the way that it ought to get conveyed. And so, you know, but again, the big challenge really is with the young generation, and it also with, you know, like you said, entertainers. I mean, Dick Gregory, I'll just say his name. Dick is a friend of mine, but he uses the word. And I think I know who you're talking about. I read something recently about this particular, you know, person that you mentioned, and they're popular. So if they can say it, then you say, whoa, well, it's okay. It's all right,
yeah,
you know, and then people take license with it, you know.
It's viewed as okay because, see, once you see someone with a kind of a radical type of comedy and that person endorses it, then, and you don't have the history of it yourself, then, yeah, of course, you feel like you've got the wherewithal now to use the word, and then you come up with your own hip-hop-based definition. But see, what I was fearing is happening. Now you got a Caucasian person who felt that he could use it, and he'll probably say, well, I heard, you know, people of African descent use it, so why can't I use it?
Right,
and see, when they're stringing us up again in New York under all the gentrification and under whatever else is going on, and they're using that word, what are people going to say? What could be said when they can say, well, you all have been using the word, and no one's from using it.
And to add to what you've been saying, these nooses, you heard about these nooses that have been appearing, one near the National African American Museum in Washington and another on the National Mall. These nooses have been appearing.
I know about that.
Oh yeah, I mean, so it's
first,
it's
really. I'm not surprised in this country.
Right.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, and the reality is too is you know, these comedians, they may make jokes. There may be a Jewish person who will make a joke about Jewish people, and they're going to tread very lightly on that. But they certainly are not going to pull out the K word and say it. They ain't doing that. That is not going to happen in any
the
concert.
Backlash.
That wouldn't happen. Or a Spanish person with the S word, or you know, and I forget what the Italian one is, or the D word in the Italian community. I ain't never heard an Italian community get up and throw the D word around. You know, with this net, that ain't happening. But with us, and that still says to me, there's some denigration and some internalized difficulties that we have that we've not overcome, because somehow or another our young people have not grasped this and that doesn't mean that they're bad, by the way. It just means that somehow or another we got to find a way to deal with it. Look, thanks much. Really appreciate your thoughtful comment.
What can I just say? One other thing. You know, I heard that there was someone named Powell, a senior Powell, and there was a junior Powell that was a reverend. And before smoking became allowed and acceptable by women, he made a comment from the pulpit saying that women have to have more pride, black women have to have more pride because they're raising up the new generations, and so smoking shouldn't be even entertained. And this was before smoking was acceptable. It was viewed as smoking was like only low women did that. But people of African descent don't have that attitude about race pride anymore.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much. Really appreciate you listening and tuning in. Thank you so much. All right, okay, can we squeeze one more caller for a minute? Let's get one more caller in before I do my closing commentary. Let's take our final caller. Good morning, you're on Vantage Point.
Good morning, Dr. Daniels.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm good, and you?
I'm doing good. We got about a minute though before I have to close out. So make your comments as quickly as possible.
Okay, so this word I think is a fascinating word, and I think it's how it hits us. I think it's totally okay when the kids use it for however they use it. The word has grown to have so much meaning, and that's what words are for. It's for communicating, and this word to me has become multifaceted and powerful. And I really feel like, you know, because what happens is whoever's using the word, whatever their intent is, no matter what they think or how down they are, if there's racism involved, it comes out. You hear it. If there isn't, you don't hear it, and it's like, okay, and everybody's cool. But when there's an issue with, you know, it just flushes you out. And I think that's something that's really powerful about that word. It doesn't offend me. I understand a lot about the history. Can't say I lived in those times, but I don't know. I think also look how much conversation and real conversation we have whenever that word comes up. One more thing is that I remember Brother Shine was going to have, I think it was Brother Shine, he was going to have a program on that word. And they actually canceled it and banned it. It was going to be overnight, you know, in the middle of the night. If we can get our hands on it and review it and maybe do it, because it's such a word that brings out good, healthy discussion that we don't usually do.
Well, I agree with that. I agree. We certainly need to have a lot of discussion about it and its history and its background. And I would still say that there are groups who have been oppressed. And I would speak to, particularly, and I've named them, both, you know, the Latino community, Hispanic community, the Italian community, the Jewish community. They're not having this conversation about the power of it and how it's a positive and negative and da-da-da-da-da. And in some instances, their immediate past experiences are not as, well, with the Jewish community, certainly the Holocaust of in Nazi Germany, but overall, the Holocaust of African enslavement is the greatest Holocaust in human history, but the immediate past experiences that we've had inside this country, you know, certainly speak in a way to that experience as well. And you don't hear other groups just simply, they're not having this conversation because it is not tolerated. It is not allowed. It does not happen that which is negative and that which denigrates us somehow becomes that which is is positive. But anyway, it's certainly worth discussion, and I really appreciate you sharing your opinion that, you know, and you said something was important. It's how it's used, and I also talked about that earlier. But sometimes it's used negatively, and sometimes it's not used negatively, and that's certainly the way it was internally, and one could say externally it's the same way as well, that maybe these young kids outside who are Latino, if they were to speak to me in a certain way, I would know that they meant it in a hostile white supremacist kind of way. So appreciate your contribution to the conversation. Thank you so much. Okay, well, that's going to have to wrap it up for today. Oh, what a conversation we've had. I really appreciate the fact that we had more time to interact with our callers. It was a great conversation. Again, this is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels. I'm with the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and York College's distinguished lecturer, but more importantly, host of Vantage Point every week here on WBAI 99.5 FM on the Pacifica Network in collaboration with ycradio.org, and we'll have another great show for you next week.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Isaac Ferguson, historian of the award-winning Midnight Ravers, inviting you to join us this Friday, June 23, 2017, from midnight to 2 a.m., when we will rebroadcast, by popular demand, our presentation of Juneteenth, the story of how thousands of African-American slaves were kept toiling in chattel slavery for several years after President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, totally uninformed and unaware that they had been freed. Please tune in to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York or WBAI.org on the web, midnight Friday, June 23rd, and learn about Juneteenth, yet another poignant chapter of our unwritten black history.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
Hi, this is Randy Credico, host of Randy Credico Live on the Fly, here on WBAI Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Hey, did you know you can actually donate to WBAI via text message? That's right, for as little as $10. Just text the letters WBAI to the number 41444. Keep the vision of Lewis Hill alive. Join the WBAI $10 text team. Text WBAI to the number 41444. That's all, folks.
WBAI New York, we're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in. Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels every Monday at 10 a.m. Coming up on the noon hour, the Gary Knowles Show is up next. Please do stay tuned.